All righty. Everyone's conversations unceremoniously disrupted, interrupted. All right. Let me go around and say hello to everyone who's here, starting with Shane and Sydney, Paul, Jim, Jeff, Jinryu, Mark, Bob K, Catherine, Sam, Amanda, Tyler, Marv, Karen, Shoketsu, Jill, Mick, Drew, Joan, Alice, John, Tessa, Katie, Sabrina, Susan, and Ruth Ann. All right. So I don't have too much to say in terms of announcements. Can anybody think of announcements I should make? Or any questions about what's coming up or anything like that? All right. I will just begin then. So tonight is our third foundational teachings class. And I'm calling it The Nature of Reality. The Three Marks and the Teaching of Not Self or Anatta. So I'm going to give a brief overview of the teaching, and particularly the three characteristics of existence or marks and how they fit together. But the main point of the evening is going to be talking about why does this matter, right? This could be viewed as just obscure Buddhist philosophy or something. So why, you know, why does it, what relevance does it have to our practice? So there's a note that even though these concepts are really, really central to Buddhism, they are, they're not a, if you will, a teaching in and of themselves. Like the Buddha never said, now I'm going to teach you about the three marks. He talked a lot about each one of them. He talked a lot about dukkha. He talked a lot about anatta or not self. So he has a whole, his second teaching, thus in the sutra that captures his second teaching is about the not self teaching. But they're generally incorporated into other teachings. So they're kind of a background to other teachings. So there are these three characteristics of all things, and particularly everything in Buddhism is from the point of view of our, if you will, subjective experience. Buddhism is about human beings trying to overcome their own suffering and act with greater wisdom and compassion. So that's what it always comes back to. So the Buddha repeatedly said, all I teach is the reality of dukkha or dissatisfactoriness and how to free yourself from it. That's the essence of the whole shebang. So let's see. So anicca is impermanence. So everything we encounter is constantly changing and impermanent. And dukkha is the sense of dissatisfactoriness or stress that we end up feeling because of that impermanence. Because things change. Things might be pleasant now, but we don't know what's coming next. the things that we have that are precious to us change and they go away, and everything is, you know, at every scale you look at, over the scale of our life, they change, and over the scale of each moment, our experience changes. And so there's dukkha is this kind of dissatisfactoriness because of that. And anatta, or not self, so there, dukkha and anatta are very closely tied together. So the gist of it is that our self is a big deal to us. And it's, you know, this whole nature of the self and how we deal with the self and how we manifest the self is a big question in most religions, actually. So the reality is we're an individual. We're a, in some sense, we're a separate being. You know, we have a life that begins and ends. It's separate from other people's lives who begins and ends on a different timetable. We have our, we feed ourselves. I mean, we have an individual experience. And therefore, you know, we're very preoccupied with our own survival, with our own reproduction, with our avoidance of pain, with our security, with our pleasure. I mean, it's just, you know, hardwired into us to be concerned about ourselves. And we are able to extend this sense of self beyond just our body necessarily, but to our children, to our family, to our tribe. But the further it goes out, the less intense and instinctual it is, right? The closer it gets to us, ourselves and our children, perhaps, you know, then there's this really central instinctual concern. So in terms of the our preoccupation with self, I like I've said in the podcast, I like to use it, if you think of it developmentally, and that when you were in the womb, you didn't have a sense of separation or self. I mean, it was just, everything's taken care of, you're comfortable and warm, and you know, you don't conceive of differentiation between self and other or the rest of the world. Pretty much as soon as you're born, it's uncomfortable. As soon as you are hungry and you don't receive food immediately, you know, there is this sense, this growing sense, and who knows, you know, within a child exactly how it takes form, but there becomes to be a growing sense of like, wait a second, you know, I'm over here, and then like food comes from over there, or cold comes from over there. So we begin to differentiate a sense of self. And then, of course, as we grow, that just becomes more and more and more complex, more real and complex, right? We definitely realize, okay, my body, this is my body, that's your body. Then there are certain things that belong to me. There are certain relationships I have. I have more access and a certain kind of influence over my mom that you don't have, right? That's my mom. So we build up, there's relationships that we have a sense of belonging, an identity with. There's physical things, and then they're, you know, eventually, you know, you can totally watch kids start to differentiate themselves. I don't like chocolate milk. I like chocolate milk, like what you like and what you don't like and what you want and what you don't want. And it all begins to become this sense of ourselves. And of course, then it just gets more complicated over the course of our lives. We have careers, we have abilities, we have weaknesses, we have memories, we have all this stuff. So, this sense of self starts to become very complex, and really anything that threatens it threatens us through some indirect way. Perhaps the further out it gets, maybe the less threatening it is, right? Definitely threaten my body, threaten my family, but to some extent, you know, even if you challenge my opinion, I it, there's a if there's a sense of self-identity with that opinion, I get defensive. I feel threatened by that. So this is what the Buddha called I, me, and my making. So the I is the actor. So when we have a sense of ourselves as the actor, I do this, I think this, I feel this, that is the I. Then the me is the acted upon. You do something to me, the world does something to me, I am acted upon, and I have a sense of myself as being influenced or acted upon. And then, of course, there's my. So there's all the things that I have some sense of ownership of or control of or concern about that are mine. So our agenda is to protect and take responsibility for, take care of, and enjoy all of the things, like the I, me, and mine. So to some extent, this is very natural. It's hardwired into us as beings. We want to survive. We want to be safe. We want to not be destroyed. Therefore, anicca is very threatening and uncomfortable. Again, over that, the course of our lives, it is the process of old age, disease, and death in the most visceral sense, but also just, you know, everything changes. Relationships change, jobs change, lifestyle changes, our perspectives change. And this is, you know, there's some of it we might be okay with things changing, but there's a sense of groundlessness, of that nothing can really be grasped. You can't really, you know, figure it out, get it all set. It kind of goes out of our grasp. So anicca is threatening and uncomfortable. And when we ID things as ourself and they change, then we experience dukkha, this dissatisfactoriness, stress. And in a way, I might have shared this before, but my teacher Kyogen had a great example of how you cannot escape from anicca. And it's not just, you know, the loss of things, but it's like, even if you bought the most comfortable chair in the world, just incredibly comfortable, had a little like massage thing in it. It was just, you could just, you know, lean back, wonderful. You know, it's just perfect. But if you had to stay in that chair for 6 hours, 12 hours, or 24 hours, or 48 hours, and not get up, like, that chair wouldn't be comfortable anymore. Like, nothing, there's no permanent refuge. So, and we can relieve, but the Buddha's insight, which we'll get to, is we can relieve dukkha by refraining from I making and my making. So, that's not necessarily so easy to do, right? And we'll talk a little bit about how that is done. And really, the next two classes are about how the Buddha, the path of practice the Buddha taught, so we can learn how to refrain from I making and my making. So I wanted to do a exercise where we'll break into groups, and each group is going to get a different assignment. So each group will get something that we can identify as I, me, or mine. And one is and imagining that you're facing impermanence with respect to this thing. You're facing loss or significant disorienting change. So one is your physical health or vitality. one is your job or career. One is a close loved one, you know, a partner, a child, a parent. One is your opinions or worldview. If you can imagine, you know, really some important aspects of the way that you see the world, and for some reason they have been challenged and shifted. Another is your Zen practice. Something in your life has changed and your practice has to look different. And generally speaking, you know, from the point of my making and me, like, if things improve and we enjoy them, we usually don't feel too much dukkha about that, right? We're like, yeah. So not to dwell on the negative, but generally the kinds of things that challenge us are when, you know, we're experiencing some loss. The change doesn't necessarily have to be in and of itself objectively negative, right? Maybe your children grow up and move out. You know, I mean, in a sense, that's a positive thing, right? But it's a big shift in yourself. And maybe, you know, a job change ends up being the good thing in the long run, but initially the loss or being fired or something like that is a big shift. Another is your mental capacity. So you face what? Dementia, perhaps, or you face just, you know, over time because of health reasons or emotional reasons or whatever, like just you're not as sharp or capable as you used to be. And your reputation. So within either family or community or within a specialized circle, like if for some reason, you know, I was no longer respected in Zen circles, you know, like how would that feel? So I'm going to recreate the rooms and then looking at each room, I'll just name somebody in the room who you need to remember which topic you're. Yeah.
Can you repeat what the assignment is?
Oh, I didn't tell you what the assignment was. Okay. I don't repeat it. I never said it. Okay. So given these things, right, and you are facing some kind of impermanence, some kind of uncomfortable change in this area or with this relationship. So first, make a short list. Doesn't have to be long, but, you know, 3, 4, 5 or longer things. So pick a secretary. A short list of things you're likely to think, feel, or do. Ways you're likely to react if you identify that thing as I, me, or mine. If you're really identified with your job and you get fired, you know, what are you likely to think, feel, or do if you're really identified with that? So that's the first part. And then the second part is make a short list of ways, and they might end up being kind of corresponding, I don't know. Make a short list of ways your responses might change if you're able to let go of some of that I, me, and my making. And if you're not quite sure exactly what that would mean or look like, that's okay. If you guys just end up having a little bit of a conversation about what that might look like, we'll talk about it some more afterwards. But, you know, imagining if you can, then, you know, what if you were able to refrain, as the Buddha says, refrain from I, me, and my making. So is that clear? Please feel free to, because oftentimes I go into the breakout rooms and people are like, what? What did she say? So any questions about the assignment? Don't be shy. I think even in the breakout room, you can like ask the host a question. So All right, so let's see. The room that Joan is in gets to think about changes to your physical health or vitality. The room that Bob is in gets to think about impermanence with respect to your job or career. And the room that Jill is in, fun, you get to think about a significant shift in the relationship with the loved one, partner, child, parent. And then the room that Amanda is in, you get to think about a required, necessary, impermanent shift in your Zen practice, in the way that you get to engage practice and Sangha and meditation and all that stuff. Let's see. And then the room Drew is in, if you wouldn't mind thinking about a shift in your mental capacity. fun. A shift in your mental abilities. And then the room Catherine is in, your reputation. All right, are you ready? fun. All right. All right. Welcome back.
Do you want the spotlight canceled?
Sure. Although you could maybe spotlight people who are speaking up for their group. Yeah, so who would like to, what secretary would like to report from their group first? Joan.
So we had physical health or vitality. And so the list of things you might think or feel or do when you're identifying as I, me, and my, what came up on our list was fear, anger, loss of identity, loss of pride, loss of independence, loss of control, wondering why. And then the other response, if you are letting go of that, acceptance, going with the flow, not attached, more present, so you're not thinking about how you were or how you might be, you're more present. Letting go of your own narrative and accepting change.
We can only hope. Thank you. All right, who is next? Catherine.
We've had the impermanence around like reputation, loss of reputation, and it brought up feelings of devastation, anxiety, at least a temporary sense of hopelessness, some fear, and one of the actions is to perhaps to want to withdraw from society or to hide. And some actions that we spoke about or some things that we might do. Oh, we also talked about how there's such, in our culture, there's such a connection to identity and I with reputation or work or what we do in the world. And so to try to detach from that we talked about one option. It started with pretending, you know, since we all had this feeling of I'm doing this because it's like, oh, this just wanting to kind of shrink from the world and this kind of fear and hopelessness, to pretend that, to kind of move away from self and see, imagine if this had happened to a good friend, how would we support that good friend? Use it as an opportunity to practice self-compassion, to kind of step outside of self. And then we realize, well, self-compassion is a bit I. You know, so it was interesting to think about that. So we talked about the need to get away from this opposition of self and other and think about our interbeing as humanity and our connection with one another, the relationship between self and other. And that division happens when there is that sense of devastation. So try to bring that back together, that we have a sense of interbeing with others, and it's not all about the I.
Thank you. All right.
I can share if anybody else is. So I think a lot of the things we came up with were very similar to what's been said already. Our topic was shift in mental capacities. A few of us talked about trying to hide it. You know, a lot of shame associated with cognitive decline. Maybe anxiety, imagining bad situations, catastrophizing. You know, maybe like there's a feeling of like kind of like a fear of death, like an end of me, or like an urge to make arrangements because of that. And when we shortly before we wrap things up, one of our group members started talking about her mom, how she was in her 90s and losing her mental capacity, and that she had become kinder. And so I was kind of curious as to why that was happening, and she thought maybe it was due to the fact that, you know, she's getting older, and so she has to surrender agency. And maybe really, maybe there's two ways to go. As you get to that age, maybe you can become gentler and kinder and kind of accept where you're going, or you can just rail against it and get all that dukkha and be more miserable.
Cool. Just before we go on to the next one, you just reminded me of, I used to go visit a nursing home, a dementia ward, and I passed this lady in the hall, and she said, "Hello, dear. Can you tell me what year it is?" And I told her, and she was like, "Thank you." And I just thought, oh, I hope that I can be like that. All right. Who is next?
I'll go.
All right.
So our group talked about relationship with the loved one. If you have a loss, relationship with the loved one. So we had a lot for the attached feeling. Not as much for letting go. So for the attachment, we had, all the other groups mentioned, loss, emotional grieving. Would our memories go away with that person? And also strong memories. A fear, kind of what do I do now? How do I feel or think when they're not here? Fear that we might lose, fear of losing the memory. Fear that we might have to change. And just this focus on what we have lost. And then also this not accepting the change, which will, you know, obviously create more problems. Suffering because we want to say no to the change.
and then creating stories around it.
You're getting kind of quiet.
Am I? Can you hear me?
Now you're good.
Me quiet? That doesn't happen. Maybe I was hitting maybe I put my hand on the speaker. Sorry.
There we go.
All right. Creating stories around it and building an argument. So for letting go, we looked at focusing on what we have gained, things that you've gained from this change, detaching so you can see more clearly, so you can understand and be more compassionate, and then let going of the stories. That's all we had for letting go.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. And who's next?
I can go next.
All right, Amanda.
Yeah. So our group looked at how our practice can change, how our Zen practice changes. And the obvious initial one is the fact that we're all in isolation now and cannot physically be in the same space to practice. A lot of us really miss the Zendo and struggle a little bit without being in that physical space. But at the same time, there is a theme that popped up around change can be an opportunity when you frame it the right way. And along those lines, we also observed that if we're not tying our practice to a physical space, then it invites an opportunity to practice more often and every day. If you're not tied to a space, then sitting can happen anywhere. So there's the physical space, and then there's also the mental space of like our community and our connections and how people come and go, but a really significant change that would be particularly difficult would be if we recalled the Carlsons breaking with their Sangha and creating a new community, and how that was really big shift and painful. Mm-hmm. Change is a constant. So never know what could happen. See what else. Oh gosh, this one was so interesting in that it in so many ways it touched on a lot of the other themes. Mm. We looked at the physical space and community, as well as how, as our bodies age, our posture changes necessarily, and how that can be difficult if you have a particular posture you really like. That's all.
All right. Thank you. I think there's at least one more group out there, right?
Yeah, that would be our group. But I don't know what happened to our group, because very quiet. And I, for one, and maybe another couple of folks, I think lost in reminiscing about our job history. Oh. And for me, it has been so painful as to bring up a lot of mud, to put it that way. Let's see if I can do this. No, I can't do that. I can't put myself on.
You can't spotlight yourself.
I can't spotlight.
That's all right. I got you on speaker view now, so I'm looking straight ahead.
Okay. So anyway, it was difficult. I think one of the things that came up was losing one's faculties or sharpness, because a lot of our jobs have to do with maintaining mental acuity, not so much strength of body, but more strength of mind. And that was important. One of us had been bouncing around a various number of jobs. Well, actually, two of us, from personal experience, and the disruption and insecurity of self and money and family and so much turmoil. I wish I had found this practice back in those days. It would have helped immensely, I think. I don't think that answered the questions you asked us, Tomio, but we'll leave it at that.
Sounds like a good conversation anyway. Interesting. Let's see, we had Zen practice, mental capacity, reputation, physical health, job, career, loved one. All right, I think that's it. So I wanted to say a little bit about how we practice with this. So how do we identify less? How do we refrain from I making, me making, my making? So I think it's, you know, Bob, you were right on. Like, for many of us, job or career, or even if whatever we do, we don't get paid for, like, our, what we do is very, you know, very tied to our sense of self. I mean, it's just, it's our capacity, it's our skill, it's our talent, it's our interest, it's our passion, it's our whatever. It's our ability to provide for our families and take care of ourselves and all that. So there's so much in there. And, you know, so I think a really classic example of this, you know, something being much more painful because of our self-identification with it is that's, you know, the job lost, for instance, is a very classic example of that. It can be so, you know, who are you if you're not this? I mean, especially if for some reason you can't just go get another job, right? Like, it's like that whole option has been taken away, or, you know, you're fired. So it's a very devastating sense of like shame or sense of failure or something like that. And when that is like, that is about me, that can just be completely, completely devastating, completely disorienting. And of course, all the other things we talked about can similarly be like that. So how do we, like I said, the practices of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, which we're going to be getting to, all feed into this. It's not like you need to get off this call and then like just, you know, just stop that I making and my making. You know, it's not that easy. Like, that, so that the Buddhism acknowledges that, you know, we have habit patterns, we have instincts, we have all of this. So like, well, how do we work with it? How do we gradually work on our minds and build up skills and build up understanding so that we have some more options? But in particularly with terms of not self, we practice meditation and mindfulness. So we learn, we just do our best at all times on the meditation cushion and off to pay attention, just to learn to be a witness to our life and to, as Dogen says, turn the light and shine it inward in particular, right? So it's not just about, oh, look at all that stuff that's happening out there and this person that's doing this to me and these unfortunate circumstances, but what is going on inside? What is my experience? What are my thoughts? What are my feelings? And not to judge them, because to judge them starts messing with them and makes it, you know, you're unwilling to look, or it confuses the process. So you're just looking. And you notice, in particular, if you're able to watch things closely and develop your willingness to pay attention, you notice how things change. And you notice things that you do not have control over. So our classic example is just sitting in Zazen. And you sit there like, oh, okay, I'm supposed to let go of my thoughts and, you know, concentrate on the breath. It's like, Well, that's not that easy to do, is it? Like, did you, you might have thought you had control over your mind, but you don't, not in the way that you thought you did anyway. So the way the Buddha describes this is he says, so we notice, he says, and he goes through form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness, the five skandhas, the five aspects of our experience. And they're all the same, but he's starting with form. Form, our body, monks, is not self. If form were the self, this form would not lend itself to dis-ease, to dukkha. It would be possible to say, with regard to form, let this form be thus. Let this form not be thus. But precisely because form is not self, form lends itself to dukkha. It is not possible to say with regard to form, let this form be thus, let this form not be thus. So there's a certain sense, like if we don't have control over it, it's not ourself. And we don't have, you know, ultimate control of our body or mind or emotions. At least, you know, not in the way that we usually think. So we just kind of, we start to notice our experience and how everything's just kind of happening and we're witnessing, and things shift and change. You know, one day you're feeling just kind of in a funk. The next day you wake up and you feel fine. What happened? I don't know. It's an impermanent mind state, right? So is that mind state you? Not really. Usually if we get into a negative mind state, we start to think, oh, this is me. But then things shift. You know, why isn't the positive mind state you? So more and more we begin to see over the course of our lives, circumstances change, mind states change, our body changes, and we can't really grasp any of it. And therefore, just naturally, we get less self-identified with it. But then we also, I don't know how else to describe this except just kind of learning, become familiar enough with our own minds that we can kind of experiment. We learn to, like, what if I approach things this way? What if I thought about this way? What if I, you know, shifted my approach here? Just so we start to experiment in our own experience and mind. And I think of it as, you know, we're wandering around the house of our own minds. And then we're like, I wonder what this does. Like, and we find this switch one day, which just turns something off. And it's a very direct thing. I mean, it's hard to find the way into it. But it really is at a certain point, you know, where you can, you know, maybe you're realize that you are suffering from a lot of dukkha. Basically, the Buddha would say, if we are suffering from dukkha, we're involved with I making and my making. If it's painful, we're there's a sense of self in there. I mean, I wouldn't say this exactly, because right, we want to differentiate between pain and dukkha. Dukkha is an added stress. So for instance, we lose somebody, there's grief. That's just pain. That's just emotional pain. We get sick. There might be physical pain. That's just pain. That's Buddhism can't. And to some extent, we don't want it to do anything about certain aspects of that. But the stress is the added part. And we're going to be talking a lot more about dukkha in subsequent weeks. But we can, if we're feeling that kind of extra twisted, fearful, you know, shame and all that kind of stuff, that is dukkha. So when we feel it, there's some I making and my making going on. We can be sure. Where is it? So once we find it, at a certain point, it's just possible to go, what if I just didn't do that? And you can only do it for a second, you know, like it's not like permanently you will never do I making again. But in this particular circumstance, you just go, what if I just... All right, you know, people make mistakes. Or letting go, like the people were saying about physical health, like letting go of our narratives about how we think it should be or how we used to be. I used to be so capable, and well, here we are now, you know, like Dogen was saying, ashes after we don't say ashes after and firewood is before. There's just something, things have changed and this is how it is now. So I don't know. I guess I'll leave it there. We have just a couple minutes. If anybody, I would love it if somebody out there has really found this teaching to be useful in some form, in a practical way, and or if anybody has any questions or something too, feel free.
I'll go ahead and jump in if nobody
else. All right, go ahead.
So I mean, like, I feel like I talk about this all the time, but everybody, like, I think most everybody knows I have one of my children has a behavior disorder, and like at the very beginning of it, you know, he would act out in these very strange and very violent ways. And a lot of me making that I did was I was like, this is my child and I am responsible for his behavior. And like, you know, his bad behavior is like somehow a reflection of me. And like what I was able to do, you know, eventually, like it's a very long time to learn this lesson, but like he's a human person and he, you know, I can't control anybody and I certainly can't control him. And if you kind of let go of like, I can guide him and teach him and love him, but like he is his own person and I cannot control him. And that like shift in mindset that sort of like, and it's pretty easy in that circumstance. That's a little easier than others, but like that was really helpful in terms of like taking a little bit of the stress off of me. Like I'm going to do my best to teach and love and be present. But at the end of the day, like it's not mine. I can't make him do anything.
That's a beautiful example. And it also ties into, I think one of the huge, I mean, we could probably talk about this for a long time. This can manifest in so many different ways, but a big part of I making and my making often ends up to being concerned about what others think of us, right? It ties into that reputation piece that like, oh, they're going to think I'm a terrible parent. They're going to, and you know, at some point, you know, I mean, I was very sensitive to criticism. I tried not to look like I was, but I was. I could be really devastated by the slightest bit of criticism. And at a certain point, I realized, like, you know, if I'm doing the best that I can, like, I can't control your mind. You can tell me if you have something you'd like me to change, and then we can talk about it. But I can't be sitting here guessing and trying to like do a dance to make you like me. That was extremely freeing. All right. Well, this has been great. 9 o'clock. Close with a verse. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Damiel. Thank you. And thank you, Mick, for sharing that with us.
Thank you all. Good night.
Good night. Mm-hmm.